I'm Jim Plackey, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Fervent Few Podcast. Every few weeks, we present you with this bonus episode of the GBH Podcast, where we chat with members of our subscriber community. The Fervent Few subscribe to GBH like a magazine, making a monthly contribution via Patreon. Members join us in a forum to talk about a wide range of topics that doesn't just stop at beer. And every week, we pick one of these topics and present the community's answers to readers in the form of an article posted to Good Beer Hunting. You can find out more information by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. On this episode, we talked to Quinn Thompson, a supply chain manager for the Craft Brew Alliance, about beer packaging, recycling, and the meaning of the word infinite. But first, Michael and I chat about Uppers and Downers Chicago and the events surrounding it, the recent Uppers and Downers beer dinner in Grand Rapids, and Brian Roth being put in charge of charts at GBH. Hi, Michael.
Hey. Thanks for coming in today and helping me out with all of my my network-attached storage.
Well, we created
my NAS.
NAS. We created network-attached storage out of a bunch of disparate drives that you had. Yep. We bolted them together and made one backup drive.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
For the team. It's going to be good.
I appreciate it.
Now you just got to get a Kensington lock.
You've said that a few times.
Yeah.
I picture it like a dog leash or something.
It's almost, yeah. It's like a braided metal dog leash that you hook into the back of computer products. Except for Apple stuff. Apple decided to get rid of the Kensington lock. The most expensive computers now have no way to be bolted to anything. It's great. Corporate IT loves it. They love
it.
Put it
in the cloud, man. It's going to be fine.
Just put the computer in the cloud. Just put it in the cloud, the whole computer, and just control it with your mind.
This sounds like something that was probably hotly debated on tech security Twitter at some point.
We have a growing security team at work, and yeah, they're not super through. Although it's funny, they all use Macs because they're more secure, except for the fact that you can't physically secure the hardware. Like, the hardware is easy to grab. Like, anyone just take it.
Yeah, well.
But... You know, who's going to do that?
It should be in the cloud. You should be fine.
Just put the hardware in the cloud. Oh, boy. Hey, Uppers and Downers is coming up.
Yeah, fast. We're just a few weeks out now. So 2.5 weeks out. February 24th, 5th annual. I think it's the 5th at Thalia Hall. Well, I can never remember exactly because the first one we did was small for like 100 people in Pasadena, California at an Intelligentsia Cafe. So I can never remember if I'm counting that one or not counting that one when I say 5th annual.
You know what?
I always say it with like insecurity in my voice.
You know what? You can have it. I'm proud to be going to the 5th annual.
There you go.
Uppers and Downers.
There you go. So you make it sound like a golf outing. But it's our coffee beer festival.
Not a golf outing.
Nope, not a golf outing. Although you'll probably have enough energy at the end of it, you could probably go hit a few rounds. But yeah, it's at Thalia Hall, and we usually get about 1,000 people over the course of the day over a couple of sessions for all these like pretty nutty experimental coffee beers. Some of them are, maybe what you might be familiar with from a coffee beer, but they're exceptional, porters and stouts and things like that. But then we also really push people to collaborate with roasters. We get brewers and roasters in the same room together for a lot of these and like have them tasting through things and learning about process and there's the process of brewing the beer, but there's also the process and variables of extracting and blending the coffees. And sometimes the variables go all the way back to like sourcing and the lots that you get from those coffees and, the drying methods, whether it's natural or washed and things like that. Like, I love it every year because like all these brewers come up to me and tell me about like everything they just learned about coffee. They become fast experts, as you might imagine. So it's pretty cool. So we get, we're getting pale ales and IPAs and golden ales and sours and ciders and things like that with coffee in them. They kind of express, the whole inspiration for it was to try and express coffee as an ingredient, not just a flavor. And you can do anything with an ingredient, like the same way you do with hops. So they can be all over the place and they could be used in different ways and different kinds of beers for different effects. And we just get a ton of them. It's great.
I love coffee and making coffee and the whole culture of it. I have very little knowledge of how it actually all goes down. Fermenting and washing and all that stuff. I have zero clue. So I'm hoping I learn a lot.
Well, at this stage, I think you could probably learn fast enough to keep up with the rate of change. But it's already like fast exceeding my own ability to keep up with it. I mean, last year we had somebody from Weiner Beer Company who shares ownership in a coffee roaster called Four-Letter Word, where they had a lactic fermentation coffee blended into a Belgian, like a Belgian dark ale. And that was incredible. Like the things that are happening on the coffee fermentation side now are starting to become pretty pretty out there and interesting. And the people are experimenting with Brett and coffees and things like that. So yeah, the stuff that's going to be on display is going to be pretty wild. I love it.
And some people use cascara, which isn't true. Even, that's the fruit.
Yeah, that's like the red cherry looking fruit that sits around the coffee bean. And people use that almost like, a, I mean, they use it like fruit or like hibiscus or something. Like it has like these tannic qualities that are kind of red fruit like. They're really interesting. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So, and we also do this thing where, I mean, if that doesn't sound nerdy enough, we also do this thing that we call case studies, where we have two or three of them per session, where a brewer and a roaster collaborate to create a series of coffee beers to kind of express either, you know, where these coffees are coming from and extraction methods, or they use it to compare and contrast certain things. So this year, for example, we have Four Hands working with Goshen Coffee to do a case study. I think it's two different coffees, but four different beers. And so they're kind of showing you how the, you know, the methods of those are different. Brewery Bavana is coming from Raleigh to do a bunch of coffee beers with Counterculture. Cruz Blanca from Chicago is doing a bunch of different stuff with Sparrow Coffee. Prairie Artisan Ales is coming with their own in-house coffee roasting company now called Spaceship Earth, which I think is going to be, that's, well, that'll be the second time, because last year we had Weiner and Four Letter Word, which are essentially shared, kind of co-founded coffee and beer. And so this is the second time we've had somebody like that coming and kind of showcasing their own coffees in their own beers.
It better be the best one.
It'll be interesting. Then we have Burial coming from Asheville, which I'm pretty stoked about. They're also working with Counterculture. Guinness is bringing, they're going to have like a special exhibit showing like roasting qualities and nitro and like these different ways in which the flavor characteristics of coffee in a beer can be kind of manipulated. They're bringing something that they just made in their new Maryland facility that's going to be, it's a Belgian triple with coffee from Guinness, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that'll be a special exhibit. We've got cold brew cocktails from Powers Whiskey. We always do a cocktail competition the week prior, and the winner of that from one of the best bartenders in Chicago gets to like serve that to 1,000 people, which is really more punishment than it is reward, but they're pretty stoked to do it. And then let's not forget the single origin multi roaster espresso bar with like six different roasters all serving single origin espressos.
Who can
with
Amarzocco.
It's fucking nuts. It's nuts. Every year I get really freaked out that a beer person is going to drink too much coffee. Because they're not used to the espresso thing all that much. Most folks aren't. I mean, as a culture, we just don't drink a lot of espresso. Like, you know.
Yeah.
So somebody came up to me last year. They're like, "Hey, I tried the espresso." I was like, "Oh, which one?" They're like, "All of them." I was like, "No, please don't do that to yourself."
Oh man,
that's different than beer.
Oh boy.
So I don't know. It's always just a wild ride to see like coffee people and beer people all getting in a room together and like sorting out how they're going to go about this experience because it's so wacky.
You're going to have to sell uppers and downers, blood pressure cuffs.
Yeah, right.
People make sure, just a check, just a test. Yeah, make sure they don't have too much coffee.
And this year we have Demos Pizza is going to do food for us. He's making like a special like coffee thing with a fried chicken on a pizza scenario that sounds like Demos, honestly. It sounds like it's going to be delicious.
When we had the bottle share here and Demos catered it, anything that had chicken on it, I don't even think I saw it. It was just gone. Like, just, oh, here's the fried chicken and waffles pizza. Gone.
Yeah.
It was just gone.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty funny, like, in terms of the kinds of pizzas they make. Like, they're pretty damn gimmicky. Like, one of them's like a macaroni and cheese pizza and things like that. But every time I like, hesitate about it, I immediately find myself eating like a third piece already.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you're like on the second piece, and you're like, man, I don't know if this is very good. I'm gonna have to try another one just to make sure this like weird.
This doesn't seem very authentic.
This banh mi pizza doesn't seem like it's Italian.
It's so ridiculous, but I love it. So yeah, it's pretty wild. And this year, Uppers and Downers it's not just the festival this year. It's an entire week of events. We're doing like some tap takeovers for what we call a decaf party, which is non-coffee beers, from some of the out-of-towners that are coming to do case studies, like Burial and Bavana and Prairie. Like, they're all going to have beers on at Public and Anchor on the Thursday night. I think it's the Thursday night before. And then we're doing the Irish Cocktail Cold Brew Cocktail Competition that Tuesday night. And then, geez, I can't even remember.
Wednesday is the learn how to pull an espresso shot.
Yeah, oh, we're doing some really, some deep dive coffee stuff. Like, we're doing like a roaster tour down in the West Loop to like where all these roasters have moved in now, like Passion House and Metric and Intelli are all down there. I'm probably forgetting somebody, but we're going to like work our way through that district. And then later at Revival, which is like one of our big food hall kind of places downtown. Like La Marzocco is going to have a machine set up there to like come in and do like a barista training class, which I need to go back for a second tutorial. We have a La Marzocco GS3 here in the studio, and we've been taught by the lovely people at Metric how to use it, but we still suck at it because it's not it's not as simple as, I don't know, it's just not simple.
I'm still learning how to do V60s. I've had a V60 set up for like almost 3 years. Still like learning the ins and outs of it.
Yeah. I mean, you learn how it functions and then you learn how to dial it into your taste. And there's just so many X factors I always wondered what some of my friends who are baristas meant by like dialing in a coffee when they start work every day. And I was like, well, why is it so different all the time? And now I realize it's because of like the coffee changing literally changes all the X factors of like grind size and what, and, you know, grams and then the time where you're actually going to run the water through the machine, through the espresso, like all of those are X factors that you get to play with to find out what you think the perfect method is for making that coffee that day. For us, that works pretty well if you can figure it out, because we're going to go through a bag a lot slower than a single cafe might. So for them, it's like constantly dialing it in. For us, it's like maybe once a week, but it's still tough, man. It's complicated. I don't know. I'm going to go back and try and learn again. And I feel like I just have to do it again and again and again until I finally just like get used to it. It's cool.
There was a chain of coffee shops here in Chicago that collapsed under its own weight. But the baristas and the coffee was outstanding. And we would go in there like in the middle of the afternoon, like when no one cared anymore. And we like would chat up the barista and he'd be like, oh, check this out. So yeah, I'm going to make you like 4 shots of the same coffee. Here, this one tastes like blueberries. This one tastes like raspberries. This one tastes like chocolate. And he was like dead on every time.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
It's pretty awesome. And then Friday night before, when we're still, we're going to be setting up for the festival, but in the middle of the floor of Thalia Hall, we're going to do a huge chef dinner with a bunch of brewers and chefs working together to create like an uppers and downers dinner that's all charity driven. And that's pretty exciting. That's a new entry this year. So that's going to be like a pretty elaborate thing. I'm pretty excited about that. And then the Sunday following, we're doing the hangover party, which is like the one thing we've always done, where we're going to hang out at Hopewell over here, just around the corner from us. We're going to record some podcasts, interview some people about what they made and like the experience of collaborating together and like really digging into the details of some of these experimental beers and just have a good time, a little bottle share in the morning. So yeah, that's...
Whew. And then are we doing, did we confirm an official hangout for the Fervent Few?
I don't know.
I floated the idea of us walking back here after Hopewell.
After Hopewell. Oh, yeah. That'll probably work.
Farewell reception.
That'll probably work. Yeah, we can do that.
Well, there you go. So if you're in the Fervent Few, get here.
Yeah, please. It's a short little walk, like 5 minutes.
No, I mean, get to Chicago.
Yeah.
Get here. Because this week is going to be, I told my wife, you're not going to see me much.
No,
I was like, I'm gonna be out, but she's gonna come to the festival, which is exciting.
Oh, cool.
She's gonna help out.
Yeah, I don't think I'd see my family much either if it wasn't Hillary actually running it all. I'm here talking about it all. My wife and business partner Hillary Schuster is running it all. It is her operation. That's like her, like, yeah, that is her battleground for the spring.
Just get to sit back and get buzzed. Buzzed on espresso
and answer lots and lots of questions along the way. That's my job, is to like, yeah, all those brewers, all those roasters feeling set up and taken care of and ready to pour for a ton of people. So yeah, get your tickets, goodbeerhunting.com/uppers and downers. That'll show you all the stuff.
And if you're in the Fervent Few, there's a discount code.
It's true.
Save some money.
Yep.
And get ready, get locked and loaded. get dialed in,
get up and down.
But you already had an uppers and downers dinner, did you not?
In Grand Rapids, yeah. So we've been trying to do these small sort of preliminary events to kind of build up awareness for what uppers and downers is as a series, because we're taking it down the road. We're going to London in May again. We're trying to like extend it and bring the experience to other people who, have maybe been thinking about it but don't really know what it's all about. And like we figure if we can bring a little bit of the party to them first, they'll get excited and want to come to Chicago or one of the other places we're going to do it. So I spent a week in Grand Rapids recently, got to know some of those folks, talked to Rick from Sovngarde, and everybody got excited about maybe doing an Uppers and Downers dinner, which we did, I don't know, a week ago, a little more. And it was incredible. We had, I think we had 4 or 5 different breweries, all paired with a different dish, working with chef at Sovngarde, which is one of my favorite places in Michigan to eat. This sort of like Nordic-inspired cuisine, smorgasbord. I can never say that right.
Smorgasbord? Yeah. I didn't even say it. I thought I had it. I didn't.
No. You said it just like me, just as badly. And it was awesome. It was awesome. Like all these brewers kind of went. I never know what to expect from brewers who are kind of participating in Uppers and Downers for the first time, like how far they want to go with it. Or if we're going to get, you know, kind of this, you know, some really nice like porters and stouts with coffee or somewhere in between. These guys just went for it. It was pretty awesome. Brewery Vivant up there brought a, they brought a Belgian dark ale with cayenne pepper and coffee that was pretty killer, that paired with some churros. So that was kind of cool. Gray Line took one of their like really fruit forward beers, kind of a lighter fruity beer, and paired that with a coffee that accentuated that fruit in a really cool way with like the acid profile of the coffee. And it was all from a roaster right across the street from Sovngarde called The Sparrows. And that was pretty cool. They actually finished out the night doing pour overs for people of the coffees that were in those beers. And some of it was actually in the food itself. So that was pretty incredible to have them like there live doing it for people and letting them taste things. I don't know. It did overall. It was a phenomenal job by the brewers and roasters and the chef of like bringing to life the Uppers and Downers experience. It was mind blowing. I just got to sit there and eat and take pictures. Like I was by no means the orchestrator of that one. Rick Musciano from Sovngarde really took the reins on that one and ran with it. It was pretty cool.
I'm having mic issues. Sorry, I don't mean to break the fourth wall. I'm having mic issues. No, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I saw the menu online and stuff. I was like, oh, that would have been fun.
Yeah. It really showed me, I think, how far the idea of Uppers and Downers has come now in terms of, like, coffee beers. Like, it's really done its job of pushing people's thinking about what coffee can be in a beer. For these guys to be making their first coffee beers and for them to be like this, like, any one of them would have easily fit in at the festival and been a showpiece. And that kind of blew me away.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to be up in Grand Rapids soonish. I'm going in like a month. So I'm going to go check out all this
sweet
stuff that's popped up.
Yeah, there's some new, I mean, the biggest things for me in Grand Rapids are Gray Line with Nate at the helm there. The podcast interview with him comes out this weekend, which I think it was one of the best conversations I've ever had about beer on the podcast, period. And before that, a couple weeks ago, we had Mitch from Speciation, which was super cool. Those two, for me, really represent where Michigan beer might be heading next.
Yeah, I really want to go check them out.
Yeah, highly recommend it. Mitch is tough. Like, he doesn't have a tap room or anything, but no. You can find his stuff. Like, I pick up his bottles at Martha's Vineyard. I stop in there usually every time I'm in Grand Rapids for food and booze.
I think that he might be doing a bottle release while I'm there.
Sweet. So yeah, hope you get in on that then. Yeah. It's a cool spot.
Yep. You have some site news. I mean, besides the fact that it looks nicer.
Oh, yeah. The new look and feel went live since we talked last.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's been awesome. Shout out to Anthony Bruno, our developer, and Mike Duesenberg for pushing the aesthetics on that. Like, they've been working together. They worked hard for like 2 weeks, like getting that thing ready. It's been cool. It's been cool to see our own brand evolve. I mean, we do all this brand work for other people. In my experience working at agencies is, you know, the cobbler's children have no shoes kind of situation. Like, you never get around to working on your own stuff, but we've been clearing some time for it and making sure that keeps evolving and keeps relevant and it's fun for us too.
Yeah, I remember you talking about it in August. Like, this is what we want to do with the site and blah, blah. I totally forgot about it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the site was new.
All of a sudden it was new.
Cool. It looks good.
Yeah, man. We're always casting our lines a little further out and like and making some plans like that. But it's cool. It was fun to work on. I really dig a lot of what we've changed. Like, it feels fresh, new, feels relevant. I dig it. And it was sort of timed with a couple changes we made personnel-wise. So, like, Brian Roth now, who's been one of our best writers, I think going over just over a year now, he is taking over as editor of the Sightlines feed, which is, like, all our news and analysis kind of stuff. And
there's
our goal there
is...
So
many charts.
I love it. I mean, he's a perfect example of how I fell in love with his voice as a blogger and like just saw him doing something that nobody else was doing and just putting in so much work on it. And for what purpose other than just like he just cared?
Yeah.
Like he was just doing so much work than anybody else. And reached out to him and just asked if he would be interested in like working with us on some of those things. So some of the things he was kind of digging into on the analysis and trend side, I was like, this is where we want to go. And it, I don't know, after a year now, like he's just taking over that whole section of the site. Like it's just his. It's pretty cool to see. I like it when, I don't know, somebody told me once, they were quoting an old jazz musician who basically said, if you really love something, do it for free, and eventually somebody will figure out how to pay you for it. That's basically how it works, is I just find, you know, I find somebody like Roth, I fall in love with him, start working together, just start clearing more and more room for him to run. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody I think is one of the best writers and best thinkers in beer right now, just has a home on our platform and is just going for it. So yeah, he's been amping up his coverage and his analysis lately, and that's all his to run.
You've seen that article that goes around every once in a while, the 18 types of beer snobs article?
No.
So this is like Thrillist article, like the 18 okay. types of beer snobs. It pops up like every 4 months. Someone at work posted it in like in our Slack, and they were like, "Look, it's Jim." And I was like, "Oh yeah, what snob am I? Is it the snob who loves beer so much he gets paid to talk about it and help write articles about it? Is that one of the snobs? Is that one of the snobs in there?"
It's like meta snobbing. Well done.
I snobbed there. I out snobbed him.
You lifted your nose so high, it went right over their jab.
Yeah, take that, jerk.
They are jerks.
Jerks.
So yeah, it's been cool. Congrats to Brian Roth for earning that spot, making it awesome.
He included my top 10 beers of 2017 in his top beers of 2017 roundup. I was honored.
Nice. How'd you feel about that?
It was
you were a data collection.
He's like, "Hey, here's this article about what people drink or what the best beers in 2017 were and the patterns." And I was like, "Cool." And I'm scrolling, and then he like credited me as one of the people. I was like, "Oh."
I think it's one of the more interesting things he does each year. He collects a bunch of top 10 lists, and then he reaches out to other people for theirs and tries to aggregate all this data in a quasi like quant qualitative way, in order to derive insights from like what is popular and why. And that's always been fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to be doing a lot more of that on GBH with him. It's going to be fun.
I saw Cooper working on some charts.
Yeah. Cooper made a lot of charts today. I don't know if he loves it or hates it, but he makes them, and he makes them, you know, they're nice and he does it quickly and
they look good.
They look good. I think it might be a nice break from some of the more fun stuff that he gets to do, which can be exhausting in its own way. It's funny. He doesn't have to have ideas. He just has to trace charts and like make them look cool.
I can't believe I have to draw another animal. I'm going to make me draw another fucking aardvark. I better make a chart to break up this animal monotony.
Hey, man. Grass is always greener.
Speaking of Brian Roth, he wrote an article about can sales. Can sales are booming. Mm-hmm. People love aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a Fervent Few topic on it.
Yep.
About how you prefer your PEPA packaging. And so I decided we should probably talk to a Fervent Few member who's in packaging.
Oh, cool. Great idea.
Yeah. So full of great ideas. That's what I do.
Nice.
So we're going to talk to Quinn Thompson about packaging.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's get him on.
All right.
And like magic, Quinn has joined Michael and I on the phone.
Hello. Hello, how are you guys?
We're good. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thanks.
I thought we'd start by talking about the Fervent Few article that just went up about packaging, because you and someone else blew my mind with this whole aluminum cans are not actually as recyclable as glass bottles, which I was writing the article, compiling the article, and I was like pacing the room. I was like, "What? No, they're infinitely recyclable. Ask Oscar Blues; they'll tell you."
I don't know if they've ever specifically made that claim.
Yeah. This is infinitely recyclable. Someone says infinitely recyclable.
Oh, I don't know.
Now I'm gonna have to Google it. So Quinn, tell us why aluminum isn't as recyclable as glass.
All right. Well, I will preface all of this by saying that it depends who you ask and who they work for is probably also part of it. And frankly, where you're from, where you live, what resources you have around you. So here in Portland, we are remarkably fortunate. The glass supplier that we use here at the brewery is located literally less than 10 miles away. So it's super easy for us to get it. The carbon footprint based on or due to shipping is more or less non-existent given the proximity. And Oregon has a bottle bill. So it rolled out a few years ago. It was 5 cents. They've already increased it to 10 cents per container. So the recycle redemption rate in Oregon is really high, which allows suppliers around here, our supplier in particular, is able to use up to, I think, about 85% cullet. And cullet is just basically bottles that come back to them via recycling services that are then thrown in a big glass crusher that they can then melt back down and use directly back in the manufacturing process. So they need to keep a little bit of virgin material in the manufacturing process for some stability, but 85% or more goes directly back into making glass beer bottles or spirits bottles or whatever they're running at that particular time. The thing with aluminum that, you know, it is, I would say, if you ask most sources, they'll say that aluminum is recycled more readily across the country simply because it's an easier stream to manage for people in recycling. So, you know, like my parents are in Northeast Iowa, a small town of 8,000. They don't have the ability to easily recycle their glass. They don't have curbside. They would have to drive it 10 miles to take it to a redemption center. So naturally, glass in rural areas or areas without bottle bills are less recycled. The thing with aluminum, based on what I've read, based on what I've been told, is that in addition to being really challenging to mine the bauxite, the raw material that goes into aluminum, it's a pretty environmentally intense process. As aluminum is recycled based on some of the ink that's on the product, based on some of the contamination from the liners that go through the process, you just get more and more contamination through the process. So you can't take that same aluminum and reinsert it back into the production process as easily as you can with glass, because glass is just a pure material.
Yeah, I'm reading here on Ball's website, Ball being a huge, the biggest can manufacturer, I believe.
Yep.
That, you know, they work with small brewers. They also work with the largest. They're claiming on their site that cans contain an average of 68% recycled aluminum. I think you were citing on glass it was much higher. They do claim that
it can be.
Yeah, it certainly can be. They do claim that it is infinitely recyclable, but I think there's probably some interpretation to that, especially if you're depending on the percentage that you're talking about that's in there.
That's the word infinite.
Sure. I mean, sure. I guess we could look at that and talk about the sun dying out at some point. So here's the interesting claim. They said they can be recycled, reused, and bought by the same consumer every nine weeks or about six times a year in kind of a perfect system, which is kind of interesting. The bauxite thing, I think, is the part that you know, the mining for aluminum. I mean, aluminum is one of the more abundant elements in the Earth's crust, but the mining of it has its own environmental impact in a way that I don't think we necessarily picture that part happening when we talk about making, you know, aluminum cans, the same way we talk about making glass. The way in which those raw materials come into being are very, very different, have very different kinds of environmental impacts.
Yeah, the mining of it, just the process of extracting it is pretty intensive on the environment. And the other thing is that, at least for us here in the U.S., there is no bauxite supply. So all of that is imported from Australia and other far-flung countries. So if you talk total carbon footprint of generating that, you have to then also factor in the freight, the shipping to get the materials here, which is what a lot of glass advocates will say goes against the aluminum industry.
Right. So technically, bauxite is mined in the U.S. to a certain degree, but it's not used in the aluminum can trade as much as it used to be back in the 80s.
Okay.
So I think it's just a disconnect about industries there to some degree. But what you're talking about is what Brian Roth reported on today for GBH under Sightlines, which was the tariffs that it might be going up against aluminum.
I saw that.
Because so much of that is coming from outside the U.S. that gets turned into this, you know, these aluminum sheets that get used for cans, which could have a dramatic increase in the cost of producing cans for craft brewers.
Yeah, even a penny or two on a can is going to have a huge impact to brewers across the country.
Now, I would imagine that some of these are things that you're thinking about because you work in packaging. Give us a little bit of a sense of what your role is and where you work.
Sure, yeah. So I work for Craft Brew Alliance out here in Portland, Oregon. I've been here for about a little over 2.5 years. My title is supply chain manager. The majority of my role is in supplier management, procuring of all of our packaging materials, and then a little bit on the warehousing, third-party logistics side. So Craft Brew Alliance, my office, I sit in the Widmer Brewery here in North Portland. So we've got our big brewery here that does, it's capable of about 750,000 barrels a year. And then we have a brewery out in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then the Kona Brewery out in Hawaii. And my role is, like I said, just working with our suppliers for all of our glass, cardboard, labels, crowns, cans, managing contracts, ordering all the product in, troubleshooting issues, and then just constantly looking for ways to innovate within the packaging space.
Yeah, I mean, for all the brands you're talking about at Widmer, you obviously use kind of the full spectrum of packaging from, you know, cans to bottles and everything, every sort of almost every variant you can imagine thereof because of the different brands you're working with. But some of that's, you know, some of which you're producing and packaging on site and some of which you're distributing from breweries that are producing it on their own premises. So as a supply chain manager for that kind of stuff, like, do you end up helping those partner breweries make decisions based on environmental factors or based on logistics and costs? Like, how do you, your role stretch across that portfolio?
I certainly try. And I would say we have a lot of process in place on the brewing and packaging side that our operations team has implemented just in terms of minimizing our environmental footprint when it comes to water usage, solid waste generated, electrical. But from the packaging side, I think what we try to do is we're trying to streamline everything as much as we can. So working with multiple different brands in different regions, you know, we're trying to consolidate our packaging SKU list, if you will.
Sure.
So the number of unique dye lines, the number of unique configurations that we use just so we can maximize truckloads, so that we can run longer combo runs to minimize downtime on lines. So just being cognizant of ways that we can combine production across all of these different brands as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many different factors that you're describing. It's like the articles that are coming out now about the costs of trucking probably escalating over the next year are weighing in on a lot of these factors. I mean, to be a brewery right now that is distributing regionally or nationally and sourcing from, sourcing packaging from around the world and dealing with international tariffs, the supply of the raw materials, the cost of transporting them escalating, all of these things are kind of happening at once right now in a way that must be a bit anxiety causing for someone in your position.
You know, it's something that breweries other than the really big guys haven't had to think about before. It's, you know, with the scale of getting big, these factors become that much more significant. And, you know, we have a pretty good sized staff here that is experts in their respective areas. So it helps to have such expertise across our team. But yeah, some of these things are coming out of nowhere. Some of them we've had a little bit of advance notice on. But, you know, we're really starting to feel the impacts of, you know, the freight piece that you talked about or what these tariffs on aluminum imports might be. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, I bet. Let's let's switch over and talk about the Fervent Few a little bit. Like, what, when you saw the article come out with everybody's kind of different opinions about what kind of packaging formats, you know, they prefer, or which occasions, you know, those things feel aligned to, from a, you know, as a supply chain manager for these things, what were some of your takeaways?
The biggest thing for me, I think, was just the validation of what I'm seeing on the shelf, or what various breweries are offering. You know, the shift of the swinging of the pendulum towards cans was very much echoed in the comments of the Fervent Few. And so it's validating to see that, especially from such a passionate and informed group. You know, from a professional standpoint as the supply chain manager, I buy what I'm told to buy, and I'm told to buy based on what the customer wants. So, you know, I don't, in my role, I can't necessarily say that it's directly impacting the operative that I'm taking, but, you know, in turn, it's our brand team who says we need to launch a new brand and it's going to be coming out exclusively in 12 ounce cans, when historically we launched solely in bottles. So we're definitely seeing it, and it's pretty remarkable, and people are passionate about it. That was the other thing.
People have strong feelings about packaging.
Believe it or not, I never thought people could get that excited about such a thing. I thought that was just me.
We're running out of things, Quinn.
Yeah, sad day when you're talking about aluminum cans.
Bad news about this week's topic. It's wine skins. Our wine skins. We have to go back to bulk to wine skins. I thought the interesting thing about the article was seeing people starting to shy away from large format, and like that once you pop, you can't stop format of beer. But like, well, I just opened this 18% stout in a 750-milliliter bottle. I guess I better go find four people to share this with, or I'm going to die.
Yeah.
I don't think I buy large format stuff like that anymore at all. Quinn, are you picking up large format stuff, or do you stick to smaller format?
No, I am purchasing pretty much exclusively via 12 or 16 ounce formats. I have a coworker who, you know, he sees the trend at retail where it's shifting away from 22s, and that kind of bums him out because that's his format of style. His wife is not a beer drinker, and a 22 allows him to try something out, finish it in one night if he really likes it, or, you know, he's financially, he's out less buying a 22 than if you bought a six pack. But I would say the vast majority of people, myself included, are shying away from that package.
Yeah, I think that lines up with me. I find myself buying a lot more conservatively in 12 ounce six packs for home. But I do also find I'm kind of split. Like, I have a couple different modes. I also find myself still excited about, you know, large format bombers of stuff that I, from breweries I really trust, you know, like thinking people are making fantastic sours and saisons and things like that. And those, you know, we've been sharing those around the studio more and more, but I find that I have to design the occasion for those. And so I have to say, like, hey, this Friday afternoon, everybody, let's shut down at 3 and open up some of these bottles that we've, you know, that I've brought back and talk about them and share them and have that thing. And so it has to be a much more intentional experience for me. And so I'm still doing both, but I find that the modes have split much more cleanly than they used to. It used to kind of be a mix of everything everywhere, and that's not happening anymore.
Well, and anecdotally, I would say I've seen more people who have started just doing the math on price per ounce and realizing that going the route of 22 doesn't necessarily make sense if you have the alternative to buy it in a different package size.
Yeah. Yeah, people are starting to do the math pretty quickly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the brewery this year is going to release a lot of their stuff in 375 milliliter.
Mm.
So they'll look really nice next to the Almanac stuff on the shelf.
Can we talk real quick about how I saw that entire stack in Grand Rapids of brewery 750s for $3.99
a piece? Talk about how cases. Why am I not going home today with like four cases of brewery?
I'm sorry, I had one car, Jim.
And it was with all your cases of brewery.
$3.99 a pop. That was nuts.
That's absurd.
Yeah. And I thought it was an anomaly. And I asked this was at Martha's Vineyard in Grand Rapids, which is kind of a nice specialty shop with, you know, expensive things. And I asked him, I was like, why do you have all of this? Why did this just get dumped on you somehow? And he's like, oh no. He's like, come back in a couple of weeks. I'm going to have all another shipment of Southern Tier in here for $3.99 six pack. And I was like, what? He's already lining up his deals.
Is that a bunch of pumpkin?
Oh God. I don't know. It was concerning. It was concerning.
Wow.
All right.
Because there was a lot of Maui beer. Right next to all of the brewery was a whole stack of Maui beer for, you know, six packs for $3.99 also. Just blowing my mind.
I don't know why this whole room is not filled with Maui beer. Why we are Scrooge McDuck just swimming in Maui beer cans.
Did you happen to take a look at the date code on any of them?
I did not. I don't really think about date codes when I think about things like brewery. It's because most of their stuff is, you know, it's going to hold up for a while. But Maui beer, I would have.
The Maui, I would be reluctant on.
Yeah, that's definitely fresh. That's intended to be a fresh six pack, yes. Regardless of what was happening there. But he told me it'll all be gone within a few days because college kids live down the street and they'll just walk in with hand trucks and walk out with a whole sack.
I don't care how fresh it is.
He's got his market figured out.
Oh, he sure does. He's got the high-low work in there for a specialty shop. Anyway. Not to derail too much from what we were talking about before, but CBA is they're in the news a lot these days.
It seems like it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you guys are going, you're either, you know, acquiring a new brand or partnering with a new brand. I know one of the bigger ones late last year was partnering for distribution with Cisco out on Nantucket, and now I'm seeing that all up and down the Eastern Seaboard.
Yep.
And then I think you guys just had a little bit of an internal structural shift with some roles, and it just seems like CBA is constantly trying to adjust and adapt and like fit the current market in the way it needs to keep on keeping on. How long have you been there?
I've been here about 2.5 years, and
okay.
Yeah, I mean, change is in the air, and it has been to a certain extent. I think, you know, you're definitely seeing an accurate representation. And I think the reason that we're in the press more so is, you know, I think one, we're publicly traded. So we just have a lot more filings that need to happen to stay compliant with being a publicly traded company. But, but the other thing is, you know, there are plenty of headwinds in the industry right now. And the bigger you are, the harder you have to try to get ahead of it. So using the cruise ship analogy, it takes a lot longer to right the course of a big ship like us. And so,
yeah.
You know, we're making some drastic changes and yeah, they get out there. So that's what you're seeing.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like anything that's happening in beer is happening to CBA one way or another, you know, whether it's centralized or with one of the brands that you partnered with across the Northern Hemisphere. You guys touch a little bit of everything. So I'd imagine that all those ripples are felt one way or another.
Yeah. And I think it's probably only the beginning. I'm curious to see what happens next, particularly as we're looking more to innovate in, in one of the press releases, innovate in spaces that aren't necessarily exclusively beer.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means yet, but I will be very curious to see where we take it.
Yeah, well, we're seeing a lot of folks like Miller and AB Proper kind of venturing into the FMB space with kind of a new idea every few months, and they're kind of toying with what they can pull out of that that's maybe beer adjacent. It's been interesting.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Quinn, we really appreciate having you in the fervent few, people like you in there that are, you know, sharing your perspective on things from a point of expertise, but then also learning from others. It's a big deal to us, and we really appreciate having you in there.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I was pleased to have the opportunity to chip in with something that I know something about. I homebrewed for a while, but I definitely can't talk shop at the same level as some of the other guys and gals in the Fervent Few. So it's really cool to see such a broad level of expertise across the audience and have that open conversation.
Yeah, man. There's even packaging supply chain managers in there. It's crazy. Shit's
crazy. Believe it or not, we do exist.
All right. Well, thanks, friend. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you you sharing a little bit more with us. We'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Have a good evening, fellas.
Thanks to the members of the Fervent Few, whose subscriptions directly fund GBH's content. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution. just like subscribing to a magazine. If you want to join, visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or click on the link on our show notes. And Guinness for their underwriting contributions. If you'd like to inquire about underwriting support for GBH, get in touch via the website or email underwriting@goodbeerhunting.com. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal. Have a great week.